To be in love, where scorn is bought with groans, coy looks with heart-sore sighs, one fading moment's mirth with 20 watchful, weary, tedious nights. If haply won, perhaps a hapless gain. If lost, why then a grievous labor won. However, but a folly bought with wit, or else a wit by folly vanquished.
So by your circumstance you call me fool.
So by your circumstance I fear you'll prove.
'Tis love you cavil at. I am not love.
Love is your master, for he masters you. And he that is so yoked by a fool, methinks should not be chronicled for wise.
From the beginning of Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona, the two gentlemen in question debate the merits of male friendship versus romantic love. In this first comedy of Shakespeare's, How Do the Women Fare? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What does the play have to say about the virtues of small-town life versus existence in the big city? What challenges does this early work present for the director and the audience, and where did Shakespeare get the plot for it? Our guests are Ken Albers, who's directing the University Theater production of Two Gentlemen of Verona through May 5th, and cast members including Joe Lulo, who plays Valentine, Patrick Reed, who is Lance, Kristen Hammergan, who is Sylvia, Santiago Sosa is Proteus, Liz Casarino is Julia, and Elena Reeves is Speed.
Welcome to University of the Air, everybody.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, let's talk about your choice of Two Gentlemen of Verona. It's not one of the big Shakespeare plays like Midsummer Night's Dream or Hamlet, or, you know, it's not as well known. What was behind your choice, and what are some of the special challenges?
Well, I didn't make the choice.
Okay.
University Theater, this is the MFA class, graduating class this year, of MFA actors, and there are 8 of them. And the university was looking for a play that would allow all 8 of them to work together on one piece and share the responsibilities for the piece. So that was the thought behind choosing Two Gents. I think it's a great little piece. It's not done very often because it doesn't have the kind of name recognition that Midsummer or Twelfth Night has. But because it's an early piece, it has its own particular difficulties and its own particular idiosyncrasies, which makes it a fun play to explore and a fun play to put together. I think we've all enjoyed the process. I certainly have.
In what ways do you see it as an early piece? If you didn't know that this was early Shakespeare, what kind of tip-offs, what kind of clues would you have?
It's got a very convoluted plot line, number one. It's kind of like a shotgun as opposed to a .30-06, you know. The language, we're going to see the same scenes down the road. For instance, the scene between Sylvia and Julia, we're going to see as Viola and Olivia in Twelfth Night again. And that scene in Twelfth Night is going to be much more mature than the scene here in Two Gents. But it's fun to see that that's where it started. And you get a sense of Shakespeare's growth then over that period of time between the early Two Gents and the later Twelfth Night. One of the things that I think is so delicious about this play is that it doesn't really have any villains. There's nobody in the play that you dislike.
No hissing.
No, there's no hissing going on.
Treatment of women a little bit problematic, though.
Well, yes, but that was primarily because of the time in which it was written.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking about the last scene between Proteus and Sylvia, for instance, which is often called the rape scene, and which I simply don't believe it is, I think we found a way to minimize that issue and still make the point of the play, that indeed Proteus has betrayed Valentine through that action. But these are all kids. You know, we have to remember when you produce this play that these are kids growing up. They're 15, they're 16, they're 17. They don't have much experience with life yet. And now they're going off to college, the big school. Valentine is leaving the comfort of Verona, which we kind of fondly refer to as Green Bay, and heading off to Milan, which we refer to as Las Vegas. And he's going to be in for a shock when he goes into that culture shift. Valentine is much better prepared to handle it than Proteus is when he goes off to join him in Milan. So keeping in mind that these are all kids and that there are no real villains, this play is really about growing up and what you learn as you grow up. Shakespeare's women, as always in his plays, are vastly more mature than Shakespeare's men are. And they are vastly better able to deal with the extravagances and difficulties and idiosyncrasies of life than the young men are, which holds true even today, I must admit.
And you've got a, you know, you're going to have scenes where a woman will dress as a man.
Exactly, yes.
Of course, it must have had an added irony in Shakespeare's time if you have all male actors. You have a male actor pretending to be a woman dressed as a man.
Yes, right, right. It's like Shakespeare in Love from the reverse side. And he uses that device constantly in his plays. There are several of those. We've added a pants role in this play because Elena plays Speed, which is supposedly the male servant to Valentine. But we make no bones about it. You know, it's Elena. We're not trying to hide it. We're not trying to lie about it. But it gives us another little twist on the casting, which is kind of fun.
This is the smallest cast for a Shakespeare play.
Actually, Twelfth Night is the smallest cast. Twelfth Night, I think, has 14. And I think this one has, at optimum, maybe double that, maybe 16, sorry.
And yet still Shakespeare manages to make the plot almost as confusing as possible with a
yes,
small cast.
Yes, 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 he does. Yes, he does. Well, again, it's a young writer starting out, testing his mettle, trying to create a story. And he's taken the story from, I don't know what the source of the story is. I don't remember. But whatever he did with the story is probably going to convolute even its original intent, because he's playing fast and loose with a lot of it. And he also plays fast and loose with time, with setting. He doesn't pay much attention to that in this play. So there are some gaping holes in the reality of the storyline, which you have two choices. You can either fill in with dirt or build a bridge over as quickly as possible and keep going. So we try to do that. I mean, in the second act, he throws in a bunch of outlaws all of a sudden.
Right.
You know, without any kind of preparation. He gets better as he grows into his mature age as a playwright, because the play starts with Proteus and Valentine talking about love and their life and going away. And they don't mention Julia at all. The name never comes up. So the first time we see her, we don't know who she is.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
So we've tried to create a little dumb show to open the play, which sets up the letter business and kind of the relationships that exist early in the play to give the audience a hint that maybe these are people you want to watch for. They're going to come back in a little bit and rejoin you again.
Is Two Gentlemen of Verona also the only Shakespeare play that has a part for a dog?
Yes, I believe it is. I believe it is. I've done this play three times. And the first two times I did it, the actor playing Launce used his own dog.
Ooh,
he had
a dog. Well, that's
yes, that was perfect.
Yeah.
That was perfect, yeah. Because the dog knew the master and was comfortable with Launce and was disciplined and knew how to behave around Launce. So that was no big deal. Well, we had trouble finding a real dog. We brought in a real dog one day, and cute, lovely little dog, a little high strung. Started to play around with whether the dog would be able to do that. I saw Patrick's face kind of go, oh, my goodness, what is going to happen with this dog on stage? I was feeling kind of the same thing. So we decided maybe we'll just opt out of this option, and let's see if we can find a stuffed dog that will serve the purpose.
Still going to steal the scenes.
Exactly, exactly. So,
but a little more reliable.
Yes, yes. Our property master went online and found us a stuffed schnauzer, which makes a very good crab, and Patrick is handling him very well.
Crab is the name of the dog.
Yes, Crab is the name of the dog, sorry. And Patrick's handling him very well, and we think it'll be just fine.
Well, let's get into a scene so that we get some of these actors up and doing it, and we can talk very specifically about the play. Is there a scene that you can set up for us where we can understand the convoluted plot enough to know what it is we're going to be hearing?
Well, let's see. Why don't we take a shot at the when Proteus and Julia say goodbye. Proteus is going to leave and join Valentine in Milan, and Julia is distressed about this. And they come flying onto the stage, Proteus is following her, finally catches up to her, and he says,
"Have patience, gentle Julia.
I must where is no remedy.
When possibly I can, I will return.
If you turn not, you will return the sooner. Keep this remembrance for thy Julia's sake."
She gives him a ring.
"Why then, we'll make exchange. Here, take you this."
And he gives her his ring.
"And seal the bargain with a holy kiss?"
And they seal the bargain with a holy kiss.
"Here is my hand for my true constancy. And when that hour in the day o'erslips me, wherein I sly not, Julia, for thy sake, the next ensuing hour, some foul mischance torment me for my love's forgetfulness. My father stays my coming. Answer not. The tide is now. Nay, not thy tide of tears. That tide will stay me longer than I should. Julia, farewell."
He turns, and she has already gone.
What? Gone without a word? Aye. So true love should do. It cannot speak. For truth had better deeds than words to grace it.
Thank you, Santiago. Thank you, Liz. It's a very idealized scene about young love. It's the kind of love that you consider will never face any difficulties. It will always be there. It's going to be true to the end of time. And, of course, we all know that doesn't quite work that way in real life.
And if you had to compare that to a scene from Romeo and Juliet, for example, when they touch palm to palm and you know, have the interchanges, what differences do you observe in the language and in the characterization?
Well, I think the language in Romeo and Juliet is much more nuanced than this language. It is also a more true sense of the relationship that has begun in that world. Shakespeare is also very clever in Romeo and Juliet because Romeo begins by being in love with an unseen character called Rosalind. And he's head over heels in love with her. And then he goes to the party and sees Juliet and falls absolutely head over heels in love with her, which, number one, is not only an indication of his innocence about all this, but, number two, it's a real indication of Juliet's effect upon him, which is much stronger than the effect that Rosalind has upon him. And in the little Palmer's kiss scene that Romeo and Juliet have, it's a much gentler kind of approach to the relationship than this scene happens to be, and more nuanced. And I think we believe it more than we believe it in this sense. When this scene is over, I think the audience will probably go, not so sure about this. I don't think this is quite going to work out, because I think that's in the little scene between the two characters.
And yeah. What does Shakespeare do to distinguish between his two gentlemen, to make Proteus and Valentine very different in personality?
Well, I think Valentine tends... Well, Joe, what do you think?
Well, I think at the start of the play, Valentine is... He's off to better himself. He's off to see the world, get an education, experience life. So he's looking for those things, and Proteus is staying at home. He's becoming a dullard in Valentine's view for love. So I think that's one of the major differences, but as Valentine finds out... when he finally does leave home and goes to Las Vegas, as Ken said, things change for him quite drastically.
There is a telling scene in the play between Valentine and his man Speed when Sylvia has asked Valentine to write a love poem for her, but she didn't tell him for whom the poem is to be written. Well, the poem is to be written for... He's writing it to himself. He doesn't realize that, but he's writing it to himself. So he gives the poem to Sylvia. She reads it, and she goes through a long kind of little sequence, which I think we can do between the two of you. So let's do that. This is Valentine and Sylvia. You give her the poem.
"Madam and mistress, a thousand good morrows.
Sir Valentine and servant, to you 2,000.
As you enjoined me, I have writ your letter unto the secret, nameless friend of yours, which I was much unwilling to proceed in, but for my duty to your ladyship.
I thank you, gentle servant. Tis very clerkly done.
Now trust me, madam, it came hardly off, for being ignorant to whom it goes, I writ at random, very doubtfully.
Perchance you think too much of so much pains.
No, madam, so it stead you, I will write, please you command, 1,000 times as much. And yet...
A pretty period. Well, I guess the sequel. And yet, I will not name it. And yet, I care not. And yet, take this again. And yet, I thank you, meaning henceforth to trouble you no more.
And yet, you will. And yet, another yet.
What means your ladyship? Do you not like it?
Yes, yes, the lines are very quaintly writ. But since unwillingly, take them again. Nay, take them.
Madam, they are for you.
You writ them, sir, at my request. But I will none of them. They are for you. I would have had them writ more movingly.
Please you, I'll write your ladyship another.
And when it's writ, for my sake, read it over. And if it please you... So, if not, why, so.
If it please me, madam, what then?
Why, if it please you, take it for your labor. And so, good morrow, servant.
Valentine, completely confused by this colloquy with Sylvia, is now left on stage with Speed, who will explain it to him.
Just unseen, inscrutable, invisible as a nose on a man's face or a weathercock on a steeple. My master sues to her, and she hath taught her suitor, he being her pupil, to become her tutor. Oh, excellent device! Was there ever heard a better that my master being scribed to himself should write the letter?
How now, sir? What, are you reasoning with yourself?
I was rhyming. Tis you that have the reason.
To do what?
To be a spokesman for Madam Sylvia.
To whom?
To yourself. Why, she woos you by a figure.
What figure?
By a letter, I should say.
Why, she hath not writ to me.
What need she when she hath made you to write to yourself? Do you not perceive the jest?
No, believe me.
Oh, now believing you indeed, sir. But did you perceive her earnest?
She gave me none, except an angry word.
She hath given you a letter.
That's the letter I writ to her friend.
And that letter hath she delivered, and there an end. Often have you writ to her, and she in modesty, or else for want of idle time, could not again reply. Or, fearing else some other messenger that might her mind discover, herself hath taught her love himself to write unto her lover. All this I speak in print, for in print I found it.
Why muse you, sir? 'Tis dinner time.
Okay, yes. So Speed takes on himself to explain the situation to Valentine, and he still doesn't get it by the end of the scene. He's still confused by the end of the scene, and they go off to dinner.
And if we're stepping back from it and trying to figure out what Shakespeare's doing here, what is he suggesting about sort of the game of love, courtship, the artificiality of it all?
I mean, or the professional writer, for that matter. Yep.
Well, I think he's expressing all of that. But more importantly, I think he's drawing a distinct line between the innocence of Valentine in being able to play the game and the ability of Proteus to think he knows how to play the game. So there's one of the big differences between these two characters is that Proteus considers himself a man about town. Valentine has no idea what town he's in terms of love. So he's easily duped. He's easily made fun of because he doesn't think that way. He doesn't think the same way Proteus does. And we get this scene shortly following the scene that we saw earlier between Julia and Proteus when they separated. We see, Santiago and I have talked oftentimes in rehearsal about Proteus has a movie in his head. You know, he's playing a movie, and the music of the movie is always in his head. He hears the music underneath his goodbye to Julia. You know, it's as if he's playing for an audience. And we actually have a sound cue in the show where at that point when he turns, the music has been playing during his goodbye to Julia, and he turns, Julia, farewell, and the music goes out like that, and he takes a moment and just wonders what happened to it. not because it's actually in reality there, but it is in his head. So I think that's one of the big differences between the two characters. And we see that all the way through the play until the very end when Proteus has to face the consequences of what he's done.
And what's going on in the big city, Milan, that wasn't going on in Verona? Why are the lovers suddenly out of their league?
Well, you know, my father used to have this saying about, and all fathers probably did, there's a lot of fish in the sea. We're not living on Walton's Mountain anymore. You know, and when we go away to the big city, we realize, wow, looky here, there's thousands of beautiful women in this town, at least hundreds, you know.
I don't have to settle for the one at the supermarket.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's very seductive to a young man and to a young woman as well, when they see all the choices available to them that they didn't even think they had. I told the cast, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up in a little tiny town of 2,400 people. And then I went away to college where the campus was 35,000.
You've got a great note in the program for the play, autobiographical note of yours. I got a kick out of that.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, and that I remember that very well. So when I first contacted this play, I thought, this is my childhood. This is exactly what I went through.
Not only more women, as you put it, but different kind of women.
Different kinds of women. Yes, absolutely. They did things that women in the small town didn't do.
And we're going to go further into the play, Two Gentlemen of Verona, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, cast members of the ongoing University Theater production of Two Gentlemen of Verona, some early Shakespeare. With us also is the director, Ken Albers, and we've talked a little bit about love and different depths of love, you might say, and the women seem to be, well, better at loving than the men. Is that illustrated again in this play?
Yes, several times. There are a couple of scenes that we can use to do this. There's one scene where Proteus has arranged for a serenade of Sylvia outside her window, and then after the serenade is over, he woos her. Also on stage at the same time is Proteus's love from Verona, Julia, who has followed him, hoping to find him because she loves him so much she doesn't like being away from him. But in order to make the travel from Verona to Milan and to make that travel safely, she disguised herself as a young boy.
And has taken
the name Sebastian. She has taken a room in a house in Milan, and the hostess has brought her to where she thinks Proteus will be found, so that Julia sees the serenade to Sylvia by Proteus and his musicians. And then she watches the scene that follows as Sylvia comes out to see who serenaded her.
Madam, good even to your ladyship.
I thank you for your music, gentlemen. Who is that spake?
One lady, if you knew his pure heart's truth, you would quickly learn to know him by his voice.
Sir Proteus, as I take it?
Sir Proteus, gentle lady, and your servant.
What's your will?
That I may compass yours.
You have your wish. My will is even this, that presently you hie you home to bed. Thou subtle, perjured, false, disloyal man, Thinkst thou I am so shallow, so conceitless, to be seduced by thy flattery, that hast deceived so many with thy vows? Return. Return, and make thy love amends. For me, by this pale queen of night, I swear I am so far from granting thy request, that I despise thee for thy wrongful suit, and by intend to chide myself, even for this time I spend in talking to thee.
I grant, sweet love, that I did love a lady, but she is dead.
'Twere false if I should speak it, for I'm sure she is not buried. Say that she be. Yet Valentine, thy friend, survives, to whom, thyself art witness, I am betrothed. And art thou not ashamed to wrong him with thy importunacy?
I likewise hear that Valentine is dead.
And so suppose am I. For in his grave, assure thyself, my love is buried.
Sweet lady, let me rake it from the earth.
Go to thy lady's grave and call hers thence, or, at the least, in hers, sepulchre thine.
Madam!
He heard not that.
If your heart be so obdurate, vouchsafe me yet your picture for my love. The picture that is hanging in your chamber. To that I'll speak. To that I'll sigh and weep, for since the substance of your perfect self is else devoted, I am but a shadow. And to your shadow will I make true love.
If 'twere a substance, you would sure deceive it, and make it but a shadow as I am.
I am very loath to be your idol, sir. But since your falsehood shall become you well to worship shadows and adore false shapes, send to me in the morning, and I'll send it. And so, good rest.
And so we have established now that Julia, as Sebastian, has seen Proteus's betrayal of her love in his wooing of Sylvia. The next thing that happens to poor Julia, of course, is that Proteus has a scene with her in which he says to her, here, take this letter to Sylvia and take this ring, the ring that Julia gave him, and give it to her.
And two-timer.
Exactly eternal love.
And he's also supposed to pick up, Sebastian is also supposed to pick up the picture that he asked her for. In thinking about how to accomplish the picture business, the designers and I talked about it, and we decided we didn't want a little cameo because there really wasn't anything kind of theatrical about that. So we decided that she'd had a portrait done. So we have a 4x6 portrait, oil portrait of that has been digitally created, of Kristen in her costume that hung in her room. And Sylvia has sliced it out of its frame and rolled it up and is now going to give that canvas portrait to Sebastian during the scene.
And do we understand why Proteus has fallen for Sylvia, whether it's in part her status in this place, whether it's something about her charms, or it's, you know, just proximity, or what is it? Do we understand it?
I think the only thing he ever mentions, correct me if I'm wrong, Santiago, but I think the only thing he ever directly refers to is how beautiful she is.
Yeah. And then Valentine's praise. He says so many great things about her.
Yes, but that you keep coming back to. I mean, she just looks so fabulous.
She's so beautiful.
And I think that the affection that he has for her is, you know, that deep, that thin. And it's the kind of affection that happens when you are free for the first time, in effect, and away from home, and you fall for that. You fall for the picture, which is what he actually wants. He wants the picture. If he can't have her, I'll take the picture. Well, that tells us again, it's getting even thinner as we go along, okay? So Sebastian comes to Sylvia's house, and this scene, I think, is all about the difference between men and women and how this kind of event affects each of these genders.
Gentlewoman, good day. I pray you be my mean to bring me where to speak with Madam Sylvia.
What would you with her if that I be she?
If you be she, I do entreat your patience to hear me speak the message I am sent on.
From whom?
From my master, Sir Proteus, madam.
Ah, he sends you for a picture?
Aye, madam.
Go, give your master this. Tell him from me, one Julia that his changing thoughts forget would better fit his chamber than this shadow.
Madam, please you peruse this letter.
Hold. I will not look upon your master's lines.
I know they are stuffed with protestations and full of newfound oaths which he will break as easily as I do tear his paper.
Madam, he sends your ladyship this ring.
The more shame for him that he sends it me. For I've heard him say 1,000 times his Julia gave it him at his departure. Though his false finger have profaned the ring, mine shall not do his Julia so much wrong.
She thanks you.
What sayst thou?
I thank you, madam, that you tender her. Poor gentlewoman, my master wrongs her much.
Dost thou know her?
Almost as well as I do know myself. To think upon her woes, I do protest that I have wept 100 several times.
Belike she thinks that Proteus hath forsook her.
I think she doth, and that's her cause of sorrow.
Is she not passing fair?
She hath been fairer, madam, than she is. When she did think my master loved her well, she, in my judgment, was as fair as you. But since she did neglect her looking-glass and threw her sun-expelling mask away, the air hath starved the roses in her cheeks and pinched the lily tincture of her face, that now she is become as plain as I.
How tall was she?
About my stature. For at Pentecost, when all our pageants of delight were played, our youth got me to play the woman's part. And I was trimmed in Madame Julia's gown, which served me as fit, by all men's judgments, as if the garment had been made for me. Therefore I know she is about my height. And at that time I made her weep a good, for I did play a lamentable part. Madam, 'twas Ariadne passioning for Theseus' perjury and unjust flight, which I so lively acted with my tears that my poor mistress, moved therewithal, wept bitterly. And would I might be dead if I in thought felt not her very sorrow.
She is beholding to thee, gentle youth. Alas, poor lady, desolate and left.
Okay, and that line there speaks about both their conditions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Valentine has been banished by this point in the play, leaving Sylvia alone, and Julia has lost Proteus to Sylvia at this point in the play, and leaving her alone as well. So I think this, you know, this scene following the wooing scene that Proteus asks, plays with Sylvia, is very telling about mm-hmm. the difference between young men and young women and how they deal with these issues.
Well, and the women certainly come out as having a more solid moral code.
Yes, they do.
Well, Shakespeare did love to, I mean, you mentioned early on Midsummer Night's Dream would be one good example of really just making fun of masculine love.
Yes.
I mean, they're just out of control, mm-hmm. and it's everything is for the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he does it with Romeo. Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, oh, I mean, yeah. He's just overwhelmed.
I mean, he's been moping about, you know, because he can't have any fun with Rosalind, and he doesn't know what to do, and so he's just been depressed. And the first option, and bingo, off he goes. Thankfully, he's truer than some of the other characters in Shakespeare, which makes it a tragedy as opposed to a comedy. But I think that's, you know, that bespeaks very highly of the women, and it also just reminds us of how shallow some of Proteus's actions are, and protestations certainly are. He plays fast and loose and easily with those rings, you know.
And we get an extra layer of that irony, what with the disguise and,
yes.
you know.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, about my height. And, oh, yes, just, yes. you know, in some ways we're similar, you know.
Yeah.
And about as fair as you were.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting that Sylvia asks those questions, which, you know, she wouldn't ask, you know, under right. perhaps other circumstances.
Yes.
But knowing that she's being wooed by this idiot who has betrayed his own love, and finding out that, well, she asks the critical question, did you know her? Because Julia gave away just a little too much information, yes. you know, in her reaction at one point. And Sylvia follows up on it which wouldn't happen, I don't think, with men. You know, the men might follow up for other reasons and on other subjects, but right. not on this one necessarily.
What do you think Shakespeare's suggesting about the rituals that we engage in? Because there's going to be other plays where he'll make fun of, someone who might put a sonnet, you know, sonnets all over the trees, or and you know, that a sonnet can drive away love. But the whole idea of serenades and letters and rings and poems and so on, what's he suggesting?
Well, I think, again, all of these people who engage in this kind of activity in his plays are young. They're all young. And this is part of what we go through as we grow up, you know. It's like getting a driver's license. You really should have a love license. You know, you have to pass a test to make sure you know how to behave and comport yourself in affairs of the heart. We don't have. We try to get those licenses from our parents. Some of them do a better job of it than others do. But we all go through those steps in our life. And I think if for each of those characters, Shakespeare finds a way to restate the same position each time, that those expressions of love can be very, very unnuanced and very simple and very dangerous, if not true. And we all make love. We all make fun of people in love. You know, parents are notorious for doing that when you begin dating. You know, and they ask, you know.
Well, siblings are the worst.
Of course. And everybody asks sidelong questions. Well, where'd you go last night? Yeah. Did you go out to the lake? Did you park the car? I mean, you know, they're terrible that way. So it's what we're used to. He, of course, finds genius ways to express this. In each of the plays, even in younger plays. But I think, he makes a lot of fun of that kind of thing because he knows whereof it comes in his own life.
The disguise, the convention of the disguise is almost a must-do, isn't it?
Very much. It's very common. It's very common in his plays and other plays.
Well, I mean, right on through, you know, 19th century opera galore.
Yep.
And I assume it goes back much farther than Shakespeare, too.
Yes.
And in the Restoration, it was all about disguises.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it was in Roman plays. It was in Greek plays. It continued up through Shakespeare, the Renaissance. Molière used it several times. So, it's a very common device.
Do you think it's more common in comedy than tragedy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and certainly it allows for, a spy, someone who can see what the person is like when they're not there.
Exactly. Exactly. And it also allows you to... gather information that you would not be able to gather under other circumstances. If Julia were to appear to Sylvia as herself, what would that scene be? You know, mm-hmm. It wouldn't be the same scene, certainly. It wouldn't be nearly as interesting. It wouldn't be as ironic. You know, it wouldn't be as much fun. So the device carries with it a great deal of theatricality.
Yes.
To give the audience the enjoyment that Shakespeare is trying to give them.
Well, we're definitely winking at the audience
exactly.
with those scenes.
Yeah, exactly.
In later plays like Twelfth Night and so on, there's going to be a lot of irony in terms of a woman dressed as a man but discussing men and women.
Yes.
Is there some of that wit in Two Gentlemen of Verona where things are said about men and women in a sort of funny identity way?
Well, there is to a certain extent. We saw it here in one place, and it appears in other places. It's not quite so prevalent, I don't think, as it is in later plays. There is a little scene between Launce and Speed where Launce has seen the way that Proteus is behaving, and after Proteus leaves, he turns to the audience and he says something like, I may be a fool, but I think my master to be somewhat of a knave. And then he talks about his own falling in love with a woman, and he brings out a catalog of her, what does he call it?
Condition.
Yes, okay. Let's just do a little piece of that scene between Speed and Launce. Yeah, starting with that little soliloquy, Launce, that you have.
I am but a fool, look you, and yet I have the wit to think my master is a kind of a knave. But that is all one, if he be but one knave. He lives not now that knows me to be in love, yet I am in love. But a team of horse shall not pluck that from me, nor who 'tis I love. And yet, 'tis a woman. But what woman, I will not tell myself. And yet, 'tis a milkmaid. Yet, 'tis not a maid, for she hath had gossips. Yet, 'tis a maid, for she is her master's maid, and serves for wages. Oh, She hath more qualities than a water spaniel. Well, here's the catalog of her condition. Imprimis. She can fetch and carry. Why, a horse can do no more. Nay, a horse cannot fetch, but only carry. Therefore, is she better than a jade. Item, she can milk. Oh, look you, a sweet virtue in a maid with clean hands.
How now, Signor Lance? What news with your mastership?
With my master's ship. Why, it is at sea.
Well, your old vice still. Mistake the word. What news, then, in your paper?
Why, the blackest news that ever thou heardst.
Why, man, how black?
Why, as black as ink.
Let me read them.
Fie on thee, jolthead. Thou canst not read.
Thou liest, I can.
Who begot thee?
Mary, the son of my grandfather.
Oh, illiterate loiterer. It was the son of thy grandmother? This proves that thou canst not read.
Come, fool. Come. Try me in thy paper.
There, and St. Nicholas be thy speed.
Imprimis. She can milk.
Aye, that she can.
Item, she brews good ale.
And thereof comes a proverb, blessing of your heart, you brew good ale.
Item, she can sew.
That's as much as to say, can she sew?
Item, she can wash and scour.
A special virtue, for then she need not be washed and scoured.
Item, she hath many nameless virtues.
That's as much as to say, bastard virtues, that indeed know not their fathers, and therefore have no names.
Here follow her vices.
Close the heels of her virtues.
Item, she is not to be fasting in respect of her breath.
That fault may be mended with a breakfast.
Oh.
Read on.
Item, she hath a sweet mouth.
That makes amends for her sour breath.
Item, she doth talk in her sleep.
It's no matter for that, so she sleep not in her talk.
Item, she is slow in words.
Oh, villain that set that down amongst her vices. To be slow in words is a woman's only virtue. I pray thee out with it.
Item, she is proud.
I care not for that neither, for it was Eve's legacy and cannot be tamed from her. Out with that too.
Item, she hath no teeth.
I care not for that neither, because I love cross.
Item, she is cursed.
The best is, she hath no teeth to bite.
Item, she will often praise her liquor.
If her liquor be good, she shall. If she will not, I will, for good things should be praised.
Okay. Now, one of the things this scene gives us is the practicality of love.
Yes, that's
this is
true.
A very practical definition of what of a woman that he has fallen in love with and the things that she can do.
I wasn't sure at first that he was talking about a woman or a dog when he started talking about the fetching and some of the other things.
But just the idea of listing the pros and cons.
Yes, yes, you know,
that's,
yes.
That's very
but
interesting.
But there's no discussion in that little Kate log of how good she looks, if she's young, you know, if she's got a great figure. There's none of that. She can milk. She has soft hands. You know, she brews good ale.
And
she
doesn't use too many words.
Doesn't use
slow
too many words.
Words,
yeah. So, and these are all very attractive to Lance. I can't imagine they would be the least bit attractive to Proteus, you know, at all. Or Valentine, for that sake.
Yes, the utilitarian
approach.
So
it's a totally different level that Shakespeare's talking about here.
Is this the Elizabethan equivalent of vaudeville we have going here, a little routine going?
It very much is. Mm-hmm. And there are several of those that involve speed and Lance with other characters. And they're very difficult. They're really tricky. But they're Abbott and Costello routines.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
They're Rowan and Martin routines. It's a long comedy tradition that precedes those acts that we're familiar with in our own culture. And, you know, a lot of the text in these scenes has the context, I should say, the context of the text in these scenes is long gone.
Yes, right.
From our experience. We have no idea what some of these jokes are. So as we rehearsed the play, we started with kind of the full scene. And as we moved along, we started to take the blue pencil and go, sorry, let's
don't
lose
get that
this sucker.
Line, don't get
There's
that
no
line.
Way we're ever going to convey anything on that.
That's so. One of the frustrations with the lack of footnotes. I mean, because I think at the beginning of that scene, wasn't the ship kind of a play on sheep?
Yeah,
and we wouldn't necessarily catch that unless we had one of the books that has the footnote that
tells
us that.
Exactly, yeah.
And some of the humor comes from puns that we no longer get.
Right, and by the same token, much of our humor comes from puns that in 20 years are no longer going to be relevant. You know?
Yep. You don't have to go back very far to find puns that you don't get.
No, and you know, political jokes
that
were funny 24 years ago, what was funny about that? You know, people wonder what was funny about that, you know. And it's very difficult to explain what was funny about it if you didn't live at that time.
And by the time you do, of course, it's not funny.
That's right.
We're going to look at the ending of Two Gentlemen of Verona when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking about Two Gentlemen of Verona, an early Shakespeare play being produced by the University Theater. For information about tickets, you can go to utmadison.com, because the show is running through May 5th. We've been lucky enough to hear from six of the actors in the cast. They have been Santiago Sosa as Proteus, Joe Lulo as Valentine, Liz Casarino as Julia, Kristen Hammergren as Sylvia, Patrick Reed as Launce, and Elena Reeves as Speed. And the director of the play, who provides really nice program notes if you go to see the production, is Ken Albers. Ken, if the show works the way you're hoping it does, what will audiences go away at the end thinking and feeling?
Well, I hope, number one, they'll be entertained and we'll have a good time. I hope, number two, they will be transported back to their own youth a bit with some new information and some new ideas about what it means to grow up with other young people, what it means to experience love for the first time, what it means to experience betrayal for the first time, and how difficult it can be for youngsters achieving that first entry into maturation, how difficult those years can be, as well as how rewarding they can be and how frustrating they can be, how hurtful they can be, how silly they can be, how funny they can be. I think that's what the play asks us to relive in many ways, and I hope that that's what they'll take away.
One of Shakespeare's contemporaries, you can maybe remind me which one, I think it was a contemporary, said that he never blotted a line, to which somebody else said, would that he had blotted 1,000. So how good is this play as Shakespeare goes, especially as you get to the end of it?
Well, I think, let's say that life is a grading curve. You know, 10% of it is A, 20% is B, 40% is C, 20% is D, and 10% is just F, you know. And it, strangely, it kind of works that way when you think about it. And I think this falls into the C category. It has moments of C+, maybe even B-. It has moments of C- to D+. And there are a couple times when you just kind of want to go, no, that's an F.
Now, that's not a real promotion for this show.
No, I understand.
This is an expose.
There are all sorts of A's, too, in it. And one of the things that the play is most criticized for is what has been often called the rape scene at the end of the play, when Proteus says that he will force his affections on Sylvia. And before he is able to do that, Valentine comes to the rescue. But I've never agreed with that. I thought it was out of the spirit of the play. It was counter to that spirit. So what we've tried to do with that moment in the play is to find a way that it's really a mistake. And what happens to poor Proteus is that Sylvia kind of decks him with hair pulls and stomps on feet, until he falls to the floor, and in falling to the floor, he takes her with him, and in the role ends up in a position that could be compromising. And at that moment, out comes Valentine before he's able to do anything. But I think the action of at that moment is clearly that he's silly. He couldn't do anything if he tried. He wouldn't even know how to begin.
So it's a comic.
Yes.
You have to, obviously, you have to make it a comic scene,
yes.
Though it has this dark side to it.
Because what Valentine is really reacting to is the betrayal of Proteus against him, not a potential rape of this woman. And I've always felt, every time I've done the play, that that's inappropriate to the spirit of the play. So we have done that. The other thing I'm really happy about is the play's ending is very problematical. It just doesn't wrap up.
Do the women kind of just fade away?
Yes, they do.
They lose their voice.
They lose their voice, yes. So we have found a way with some restructuring of text at the end of the play where I think the ending is now quite sweet and quite lovely and gives us an ending that we kind of want in a Shakespeare comedy about love, as opposed to it ends with a bang now, I think, rather than a whimper.
And is that a choice that's a little controversial if you start rewriting Shakespeare?
No, because he's dead.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's got nothing to say about this.
So you gave up on academic purity long ago.
Oh, yeah, a long time ago. No, I mean, I've always wanted Shakespeare in the hall with me, so that at some point during these scenes I can turn to him and say, will you fix this, please? You've avoided this for 6 weeks now. Go off in a corner and rewrite it.
Now, I've seen some Shakespeare plays where they put people on motorcycles. They've got them in modern dress. I saw A Merchant of Venice where people were carrying, you know, laptop computers and everything. And in this case, are you going with traditional costuming and setting, or is there any hint visually that this can be taken into our own time, into Las Vegas and all the rest of it?
We have, our costume designer has been very clever in combining late 18th century and the 1950s. So actually we're in the 50s, but with a classical look of the 50s. And it's quite fun. I think it'll be quite fun. The set is an open set. It's a single unit set, so the play can keep moving. The serenade to Sylvia smacks a little bit of Elvis Presley. So we have made some of those things, some of those decisions to the 50s. As I said earlier in the program, that's where this play has always lived for me, was in my childhood in the 50s. So that's what I always think of when I think of this play.
So instead of a sword fight, you're going to run over somebody with an Edsel.
Yeah, that's kind of it, yeah.
What do you do to show the movement from a small town to the what you call Las Vegas? What do we see visually?
Well, you see a lot of light difference. Number one, and the big difference is in the costumes. We come out of Verona, which is reasonably neutral, and browns and blacks and grays, and you hit Milan, and now we're into reds and yellows and purples and greens and you know, all sorts of bright colors. That's mostly where the definition lies, the difference lies.
Do you think some of the actors and some of the audience members will go home and change their Facebook status and have all kinds of changes in their love life because
of this?
I could
care less about Facebook. I'm the last living person not on Facebook.
Do we have any sense of what Shakespeare's audience thought of this play? I mean, or was it just kind of played and then they went on to the next new play?
I think it was kind of played and off they went. There's not much record of the reaction to the play. There's not much record of the reaction to any of Shakespeare's plays. Critical writing was in its infancy at that time. And I don't think Shakespeare cared much about that. He was too busy trying to make money. So he was cranking out these plays like there was no tomorrow. And because of that, I think also that's one of the reasons that this play has some difficulties textually and structurally, is he's really writing fast.
And perhaps rewriting fast, too.
And rewriting fast. Yeah,
right on the scene.
There is a scene at the end of the play where, just after the, quote, rape, Valentine, Proteus, confesses and seeks Valentine's forgiveness, and Valentine forgives him. And that's always been a problem in this play.
Uh-huh.
Well, I saw a production of it years ago at Marquette University, and they had added a character of Shakespeare who sat off on the side of the stage throughout the entire production. And he, every once in a while he would make a note of something that he saw on the deck. And when they got to that scene, all of a sudden he is furiously writing down here, okay? And he stops the play, and he walks over, and he hands the piece of paper to Valentine. And on the piece of paper, you realize, is what's about to happen next, which is the forgiveness of Proteus. So he hands that to Valentine, and Valentine reads it, and he just looks at Shakespeare, and he says, what? And Shakespeare's, what? And he reads the line. He reads it. I thought, that's not a bad solution to that little problem.
Sure,
actually.
It's almost play within a play.
And it was pretty funny. Yeah. So, but I didn't do that.
Well, thanks for sharing. thanks for sharing Two Gentlemen of Verona with us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been director Ken Albers and half a dozen members of the cast. Great having you with us.
And,
as the play continues, break some legs. Break at least half a dozen or so of those. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.